Founded in 1729, Arlington Street continues today as a gathering place for progressive people of faith in the greater Boston area and beyond. We are located at the corner of Arlington and Boylston Streets, across from the Public Garden in Boston, Massachusetts. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.
I'm substitute teaching a seventh grade math class in a room with a broken AC. Can you imagine? The students, less than a week away from the freedom of summer break, are screeching and throwing crayons. In the fall, I will be starting a grad program in secondary teaching. Today has me wondering if I'm really cut out for this. But when I roll up my sleeves, the students are suddenly called to attention. One of the crayon throwers, a boy in a Pittsburgh Steelers jersey, points at me and says, "Y'all better shut up now. This guy has a tattoo. He is not playing." The tattoo in question, still raw and red and raised, is of the Velveteen Rabbit, the hero of Marjorie Williams' classic children's book. Somehow, this does not diminish whatever street cred I've won by virtue of having a visible tattoo. When people ask me why I have the Velveteen Rabbit tattooed on my forearm above the words, "You become," I sometimes respond with a white lie. It was my favorite book when I was a kid. This is often easier than, "Because when I was 22, I had a nervous breakdown and nearly dropped out of college, but instead went to see a therapist named Linda who read me a passage from The Velveteen Rabbit that made me weep and ultimately helped me discover the spiritual value of suffering in a way that Dostoevsky could only dream of." If you haven't read it, the titular hero of The Velveteen Rabbit is a stuffed animal who has been relegated to the refuse heap of the nursery, and he's very concerned with the question of how to become real. Realness is the quality that he thinks give the mechanical toys and model boats a leg up on him in the highly stratified society of toys. But the skin horse, the sage elder of the nursery, knows better. And in the passage that my therapist read me that day, the skin horse tells the Velveteen Rabbit, "Real isn't how you are made. It's something that happens to you. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't happen often to people who break easily, or have sharp edges, or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you're real, most of your hair has been loved off, and your eyes drop out, and you get loose in your joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand." There is a reason why so much great literature deals with characters who find themselves in the midst of a crisis. Dante Alighieri's The Inferno, an epic poem recounting the poet's passage through the eight circles of hell, begins with the lines, "Midway in our life's journey, I went astray from the straight road and woke to find myself alone in a dark wood." The Inferno is the first installment of a trilogy in which the poet passes first through hell, then purgatory, and finally, heaven. Translated into theological terms that sidestep a belief in hell and a preoccupation with sin, here is my great takeaway from Dante. There is no such thing as a one-way flight to paradise. All paths to beauty or truth or meaning must eventually pass through a dark wood. When my therapist read me that passage from The Velveteen Rabbit, the part that made me nervous was, that's why it doesn't happen to people who break easily. In the midst of a nervous breakdown, it was easy to feel as though I was someone who broke easily. I couldn't write, couldn't read, couldn't think. My brain felt quite literally broken. It was only by blind faith that I came to believe that what felt like breaking might be something else entirely. Maybe this was just what it felt like to become. And that, of course, is the lesson of the Velveteen Rabbit, that the process of becoming will make us shabby, loosen the joints, worn down until what is essential within us is made visible, until we become real. This is what makes breakdowns so attractive to fiction writers. When things are going well in a person's or character's life, they are less likely to look around and wonder, what is it all about? Well-rounded, vividly described characters are nice, a fiction teacher once counseled me. But if you want to make them mean something, you kind of have to blow their lives wide open. In times of trouble, we turn to breakdown stories, not just for hope that things are going to get better. In many cases, they don't. But to see how other people make sense of their suffering. Atessa Moshfegh's 2018 novel, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, follows an unnamed narrator through her post-college malaise, characterized by a complicated grief for her recently dead parents, an unfulfilling situationship with an older man, and a tenuous connection with a best friend she seems at times to despise. Wholly disenchanted with life, she decides on a radical experiment. She will spend 1 year confined to her apartment, functionally hibernating under a cocktail of sedatives. In doing so, she is essentially hoping to unplug her life and plug it back in, to emerge from her prolonged slumber with a new lease on life, a new perspective. This impulse towards total isolation in a period of crisis might be familiar to anyone who has weathered a breakdown. But while the narrator's conscious self takes increasingly drastic measures to wall herself off from the rest of the world, her subconscious counterpart seems to have other plans. While sleepwalking under the sedatives, the narrator ventures out of her apartment to go clubbing, to wander around the city, and even to attend the funeral of her best friend's mother. These unconscious journeys out of the apartment signal an important truth about breakdowns. What we need in times of crisis is connection. By the end of the novel, the narrator does eventually realize this, but in that classically tragic way, the epiphany comes just a little bit too late. It's easy to understand the appeal of isolation when we feel fragile. The trouble is that in the midst of a breakdown, we don't always have the best ideas about what will get us out of them. The great thing about breakdown literature is that it can teach us a lot about what doesn't work. Thanks to Dostoevsky, I can confidently tell you that murdering a pawnbroker in cold blood to prove that you have transcended the boundaries of human morality doesn't work. What we need in times of crisis is connection. The process of becoming does not happen in isolation. The Velveteen Rabbit could not have become real without the wisdom of the Skin Horse. Dante could not have emerged from his dark wood without the guidance of Virgil. Even Dostoevsky's famous slayer of pawnbrokers, Rodion Raskolnikov, is eventually redeemed through the unrelenting compassion of those around him. In Russian, the last name Raskolnikov derives from the word raskolnik, which means schism or divide. Bad things happen when we divide ourselves from those who might otherwise comfort or guide us when we feel broken. When my second breakdown hits, I am 30 years old. After 5 years of teaching high school, I have taken a detour to pursue a graduate degree in fiction writing. As much as I loved teaching, I had been quietly nurturing a passion for writing that I wanted to devote more time to, even if it meant leaving behind the extremely relative financial stability of a career in public school teaching. By the end of my first semester in the program, my bank account is empty, my mental health is not great, and somehow I have not yet been published in the New Yorker. Worst of all, my brain is starting to do that thing again, that refusing to read, refusing to write, refusing to think thing. I power through and finish the first semester just barely. And then comes winter break. My roommates and most of my friends in the program are off visiting family. I tell myself that a quiet winter confined to an empty apartment will be just the thing for my writing. Instead, I spend my mornings in bed staring vacantly at the paint stain on the back of my bedroom door that looks like a backwards question mark. This proves to be the only method for warding off grim and grotesque visions of my future. I realize what's happening to me. I'm breaking again. This time, I find little comfort in telling myself that this is what becoming feels like. In a few weeks, my roommates will return, and the thought of their presence in the apartment fills me with dread. I know I can't hide my breaking from them. I haven't told anyone about what I'm going through. It doesn't seem fair to burden my loved ones, knowing as I do that I'm beyond help. I am free-falling towards rock bottom. When I hit ground, when I am no longer breaking but broken, then I'll tell them. By the end of the first week of winter break, I am desperate to get out of the apartment. I text the one friend who I know is still in town. I figure it will be good practice for me for being around people before my roommates get back. Jason and I are both teaching assistants at the university, and we share an office. We are friendly, but not especially close. In my mind, this makes it less likely that I will break down crying in front of him. We are both too broke to go out, but he says he has a frozen pizza we can share. The simple kindness overwhelms me. When I open the door to his apartment, when I see him unboxing the pizza, I begin to cry. Over the next hour or so, I tell him all that I can articulate about my breaking, and he listens. Jason is a poet and recent graduate of Harvard Divinity School, which, as far as people to accidentally break down crying in front of, not too shabby. At one point in the conversation, he suggests that I need a mantra to get me through this. I scoff. I might be crazy, but not in a New Agey way. Then he asks about my tattoo, and I give him the long answer because he's already spent the last hour watching me cry. He's not familiar with the Velveteen Rabbit, so I try to explain what you become means. I do a lousy job. It's like the rabbit wants to be real, and this other stuffed animal tells him that you can only become real when you get worn down at the seams and your hair falls out. Like being real means that you have to get all janky. And that's what this particular breakdown has really been about. I want to become who I'm supposed to become without getting janky and crying in front of people so much. I'm losing faith that my jankiness means that I'm becoming anything other than jankier than I was the year before. But the next day, I tell Jason that I think I have a mantra. Whatever I'm becoming is something worth being. And then I cry some more because now I'm the kind of person who has to say that kind of thing to himself. But I keep saying it. Before I go to sleep each night, I fidget with a knot of old string and say it again and again and again. It begins to feel like a prayer, something I have never done before. I was not raised religious, and yet here I am praying. Not once in my life have I imagined myself going to church, and yet the following Sunday, I find myself sitting in a pew in Portsmouth's South Church. A close friend of mine had grown up in UU, and I'd always known in the back of my mind that it was somewhere I could go if I found myself in sudden need of community. The sermon is about wintering, about weathering periods of despair and sorrow. You will find your wisdom in winter, the minister reads, and once it's over, it will be your responsibility to pass it on. Her words make me think of Jason and of all the other loved ones I have since chosen to open up to. about their relentless compassion that I feel a long, long way from being able to pay back. But suddenly, my mantra rings true in a way that it hasn't before. Whatever I'm becoming is something worth being. If I can get through this, maybe I can show up for people in a way that I couldn't before. And that proves to be the case sooner than I could have imagined. My roommates eventually return. The semester starts up again. It doesn't happen all at once, but in time, I begin to feel better. As we get deeper into the semester and work picks up, I see less and less of Jason. And then one day, in the middle of the week, he calls me up and asks me if I could come over for dinner. After helping me through my season of despair, Jason has now found himself lost in one of his own. Although the details of his crisis differ from mine in many ways, one thing they share is the initial impulse to hide away. But when his situation gets to the point that he needs to talk to someone, I am the obvious choice. He tells me that I taught him how to ask for help. I tell him that he's lucky that someone has recently taught me how to give it. Just as we did a few months before, we stay up all night talking. The sun is rising when I get up to leave his apartment. I absentmindedly reach into the pocket of my jeans and find the old knot of string, the one that I fidgeted with while praying in those early days of my recovery. Now, I stand dumbstruck as I stare at it in my palm, because it has been missing for a little over a month. That I should find it now, this janky approximation of rosary beads, feels, I have no other word for it, holy. I think I'm supposed to give this to you now, I tell Jason. When I think of faith, I think of this moment. A knot of old string, a mantra, a prayer. Whatever we are becoming is something worth being. Amen. And now for our benediction, I invite you to put your hands over your heart in namaste. I bow to the divine in you. Once again, in the words of Catherine May, you will find your wisdom in winter. And once it's over, it will be your responsibility to pass it on. Let us keep this faith, beloveds, and pass it on. The service begins when the service ends. Bless your hearts. Amen.
Where you go, I will go.
We are located at the corner of Arlington and Boylston Streets, across from the Public Garden in Boston, Massachusetts. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.